Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For better or worse, they were the Replacements. This is Soundcheck. I'm Joel Meyer, sitting in for John Schaefer. Coming up on the show, a live performance from acoustic folk songwriter Dar Williams, and we'll find out about the first ever symposium on the Godfather of Soul. But first, in the mid-1980s, the Replacements stumbled out of the red-hot Minneapolis music scene and onto the national stage. And if you grew up in that city, like I did, everyone you know has a story about Paul Westerberg, Chris Mars, or the infamous Stinson Brothers. Now, some of those stories are true, some are not. Most involve beer. A lot of it. The Twin Cities music critic Jim Walsh has collected hundreds of stories about these legendary rock underdogs in a new oral history called All Over But the Shouting. In addition to writing about music, he grew up with the band and he has a few stories of his own. Jim, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, Joel. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing great, and it's great to have a fellow South Minneapolitan across
the table from me.
And we're here to talk about one of the bands that came out of South Minneapolis and became a very famous band in the 80s. They formed in 79, and they were a band for about 12 years, but they've been broken up for about 15 years now. So why a book now?
It's time. I mean, people asked me to write a book for years. A lot of people had approached me. And finally, I had some time, and I just thought, you know, people are dying. people my age, people around rock bands, people in general, and start dropping like flies. And I just thought, I got to get some of these stories down. And because they were a phenomenal band and a phenomenal sort of cultural moment, I think. Yeah. And so, you know, it was time to do it.
Their legend is sort of, you know, it's firmly a part of the rock mythology, and they've been written about to a certain extent. What did you want to cover on the Replacements that's not there already?
I wanted to convey the fact that they were I think Paul's songs have not gotten their due. Paul Westerberg. I think that he's one of our great songwriters. I also think the band, just as a live entity, was as good as it gets because they really, really were not a put-on thing. They you know, if they wanted to play, they played. And if they didn't, they didn't. And the spirit of rock and roll, the spirit of that band was raw and real and never very practiced or rehearsed, though they were a great band on all musical fronts. But it was a coin flip. It was, you didn't know what was going to happen. And there were a couple of years there where I was bored silly by their shows, but there were also shows that absolutely, you know, damaged me as a music listener for the rest of my life, where nothing really compares.
Jim, I wanted to read to you a comment that was posted on our website at WNYC.org. Even before we got on the air today, someone had weighed in with a comment about the Replacements, who Dave from New Jersey called the anti-band. Dave writes, every time it seemed they were ready to break out, they always would find a way not to, whether it was shaving off their eyebrows or making a one-shot video or falling down drunk at a show. Dave says, I've seen them many times, and they could be the worst act you've ever seen, or the best, depending on how much they drank that night.
I think he's right on, and I think it was a very human experience. Raw and real, flawed and fantastic, I mean, at the same time. And that, to me, is, you know, the human experience.
Why do you think that, with all of those flaws, usually those flaws stop a band from being successful. Why do you think that the Replacements did enjoy success? They signed to a major label, they made videos, they made some notorious television appearances and things like that. Why did they ultimately become a successful band, given those flaws?
The songs. I think the songs, that's why I wrote the book. I mean, there's kids buying this book right now who are in their teens and early 20s who are just being introduced to the band for the first time. And the songs remain. Those records are timeless. They're, you know, you can't deny those. They can, you know, crap all over their songs live, but the records remain.
Let's take a listen to one song. This is The Replacements when they were in their early 20s. This is from 1981's Stink. This is Kids Don't Follow. We're talking to Jim Walsh here on Soundcheck. That's Kids Don't Follow from The Replacements album Stink, their second album, technically an EP, here on Soundcheck. We're talking to Jim Walsh. He's the author of the book, The Replacements, All Over But the Shouting, a new oral history that he's compiled. Jim, as I mentioned before, we're both from Minneapolis. I'm a little bit younger than you are, and I was starting to listen to music right about the time that The Replacements broke up. So I never, I have to say, I'm actually not a huge Replacements fan per se, because I wasn't listening to the music when they were making records. But there's a legend that lives on about them after that. And, like, you know, there are stories that are sort of true and some that are not. There's sort of a legend about the founding of the band. And here's the version I know. And like so many myths, like old blues myths or whatever, it's probably riddled with holes. They are young kids. They're in their sort of late teens. It's 1979. They're in a basement or a garage, and Paul Westerberg walks by, the man that would become their sort of front man, and hears Stinson and Mars playing in a basement with another guy, and kind of joins in their band and sort of steals their band, and then they recruit their Bob Stinson's 12-year-old brother to play bass.
Right.
And then they go on and become rock superstars. How true is that?
Well, the rock superstars part is not true. I would contend. All of that is very true. Paul called, you know, the dude a hippie. He was reading lyrics, sitting down, singing, and, you know, Paul just went in there and started screaming into a mic. So, yeah, absolutely. Very true.
All right. And they did they cultivate their underdog image from the beginning?
No, I think that whole thing, these are the underdog thing and the drinking thing, all of that was true, but I think they were shy. I think they played music because it was, you know, they were kind of dead-end kids to some degree, and it was their way of connecting with the world. And it was Mark Perlman from the Jayhawks says in the book, they were more than a band, they were a gang. And, you know, I love the book because it conveys that idea of what it's like being in a band. You know, these four very disparate personalities getting together, and that was the allure, because you would go and you would watch them and you would go, God, you know, that's what the allure we all have for watching rock bands.
Someone in the book describes them as four different guys playing in four different bands.
Right. Danny Murphy from Soul Asylum talks about it like that. And it's like, that's the fascination with it, because we all look at a band like a family, and you see them, and you see them exchange looks and notes and harmonies. And these guys were, you know, a very combustible family. And they made great records. So that's my bottom line.
You know, we've talked about some of the people that are in the book. You mentioned Dan Murphy, a local musician, and Gary Lewis, a local musician. How big do the Replacements become outside Minneapolis? You and I, as people from Minnesota, can sit here and talk about the Replacements, but how significant are they outside of that region?
Again, that's why I wrote the book. I was in New York in July playing some gigs, and I walked through Times Square one night, and I was, you know, I stopped any sort of interesting sort of punk rock looking kid or 20-something, and I said, hey, have you ever heard of the Replacements? And to a person, they said no. And I said, have you heard of the Ramones? Well, yeah. I go, go listen to the Replacements, you knucklehead. So, sorry, it's true. It's you know, I'm confused now even. I don't know who, you know, people come up to me with references like from their songs and stuff, and I'm sort of amazed because I've lived this past year, you know, with the minutia. But now people are saying to me, well, yeah, I know the Replacements. Of course I know the Replacements. So I don't have that perspective, I guess, is the answer.
We're talking to the Twin Cities music critic, Jim Walsh. He's the author of The Replacements, All Over But the Shouting, A New Oral History. And he's going to be sort of reading and performing over the course of the weekend and into early next week. There are more details about it on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org, but he's performing tomorrow night at Banjo Jim's, and which is also functioning as like a Replacements tribute evening as
right
well
on.
Too.
New York songwriters playing Matt songs.
On Monday, he's at the Ace of Clubs at the Acme Restaurant, and on Tuesday, there's a reading at the Borders near Columbus Circle. That's at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. You had mentioned about wondering where their music stands now. Just yesterday, here on Soundcheck, we were talking about the top 100 indie albums of all time, and Blender Magazine has compiled such a list. Coming in at number 3 is the album Let It Be, which by the Replacements ranks consistently in the sort of top 10 of all time, you know, underground albums. What is it about Let It Be that makes it such an enduring record?
It's, you know, there are songs about, you know, growing up and love and lust and rock and all the timeless, and they're just, you know, the production's amazing. It really, really captures a time that is timeless. Number 3, what's 1 and 2?
1 and 2 was Daydream Nation by Sonic Youth, and number 1 was Slanted and Enchanted by
whatever, Pavement. New York, whatever.
Well, let's hear a track from Let It Be. You know, we heard the more hardcore-influenced Replacements before. This is the pop side of the band that you'd hear in further years. This is 16 Blue from 1983's Let It Be.
Drive yourself right up the wall. No one.
Blue by the Replacements from Let It Be here on Soundcheck. We're talking to Jim Walsh about his book All Over But the Shouting, an oral history of the Replacements. Let's talk about the members themselves. You know, you've compiled hundreds of stories about the Replacements, but in the book they only appear as from clips from articles and things like that. Why no Replacements in the book?
There are Replacements in the book, but they're culled from old interviews. The band did not want to be involved. Paul said to me he didn't want to get in the way of our friendship. He and I have been friends for years, and three things actually. He said unauthorized sells better than authorized, and he's like, you know, he's the Chuck Berry's greatest student, basically speaking, right there. And you know, number 3, he was just, you know, you or I would not want to talk about 25 years ago at all. I mean, it's a boring prospect, and I didn't want to do it after I had that conversation with him. I said, forget it, man. I'm going to go on to do something else. And we had another conversation. I thought about it a little bit, and then I just thought it really freed me up to dig in my basement, dig in archives, and find quotes that really brought that time to life again and really explain it more than these like jaded 40-something dudes, you know, that would be like going, I don't remember anything, and we weren't that good.
You know, one character that comes through in the book, sort of as you're talking about, is you. Your articles, essentially some of your thoughts and feelings come through in the book. Why so much of you in the book?
Because I'm a very personal writer. I'm an essayist that way. I have been my whole life. And the band meant a lot to me. Also, I think that it was important to state up front that, you know, I am a musician from that time, and that those guys and I have had friendships over the years. So, yeah, and plus I was a journalist and documenting the whole thing as it happened, and, you know, as all the actual news stories came out, too. So,
as you mentioned, these guys are your friends. Have you had any reaction or feedback from them on the book? Have they taken a look at it, or...?
They have, and their reaction to me will remain between them and me.
Mysterious.
Only because, not mysterious. I just don't want to speak for those guys. I'm sort of like, you know, when this is all over, I'm done talking about the Replacements because, you know, they can speak for themselves. If whatever they have to say, they're going to write their own books, I'm sure, and that'll be cool. But I just sort of feel like, for me to walk, you know, traipse around the world saying, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways, I don't think that's my place.
We're talking to the Twin Cities music critic Jim Walsh about his Replacements oral history all over but the Shouting. Jim, let's talk about when the band signs to a major label, because a lot of people pinpoint the Replacements signing to a major label, associate it with REM doing the same thing and Husker Du. It's an important mm-hmm. time in the mid-1980s for rock and for underground music. Mm-hmm. Why do the Replacements want to be on a major label?
They want to be on the radio. They wrote great pop songs. I Will Dare should have been, you know, I Will Dare or Kiss Me on the Bus or, you know, name a song. There's 50 songs that could have been on the radio, and that's the only way you could do it then. They were ambitious. They, you know, for all the talk of that they didn't care, they cared deeply. Listen to those records.
They care deeply. But
they wanted
to be on the radio, but they didn't particularly want to make compelling videos. And I'm talking about the Bastards of Young video. Can you tell people who aren't familiar with that famous video what happens in it?
It's a shot of a stereo speaker in a kid's foot. Now, you used the word compelling. I would argue that that's one of the more compelling videos. If we're still talking about it right now, it's not a Mariah Carey video that we remember.
But why is it compelling?
Because it's art. Because it's like a Fluxus thing almost. We remember it because it speaks personally, I think, to the viewer, like, this is the experience of listening to music, not a video. It is an anti-video.
This is the song from that video. This is Bastards of Young from the Replacements. Tim, here on Soundcheck.
God, what a mess. All a ladder of success. Will you take one step and miss the whole first run? Dreams unfulfilled. Graduated unskilled. Repeats been caught and waiting to be forgotten. When all the sons of no one, bastards of young. When all the sons of no one, bastards of young. The daughters and the sons. Clean your baby womb. Trash their baby.
Bastards of Young by the Replacements here on Soundcheck, the famous video of just the foot tapping and the stereo speaker. Jim, you know, we only have a couple of minutes left, so we need to sort of get to how the band ends. You know, they signed to a major label, they put out more albums, they become very famous. They're on live television, they do an infamous SNL appearance and things like that. But how does the band end?
Bob Stinson, the guitar player, they kicked him out. They fired Peter Jesperson, who was their mentor, manager, and replaced Bob Stinson with Slim Dunlap. And, yeah, Bob Stinson died in 1995. And from the moment they signed with Sire, they made you know, really good records after that. But it's... I just think they just, you know, they were, I described them in the book as a comet, you know, and I don't think they were in it for the sort of Aerosmith, Rolling Stones, let's get it up again kind of thing. They were of a moment and, again, real and raw, and they were bound, they were, it's sort of like my editor said to me, he said, you were sort of doomed to write this book. They were kind of doomed to die, too, as a band. I don't know that you can keep that kind of, you know, furious sort of carpe diem up for much more than maybe 12 years.
As you know, Bob Stinson passed away. You mentioned that, and his spirit sort of is a distilled version of the replacement spirit. Mm-hmm. Where can you hear that spirit today in contemporary music? What bands or artists do you think owe them a debt or are influenced by them?
I think that, you know, for me, it's Ike Riley. Ike Riley is just an amazing songwriter. Again, has not gotten his due. His band, the Ike Riley Assassination, just is one of the great rock bands going. And, you know, the Minneapolis scene right now is more vibrant than it has ever been. It's incredible. I had to come to New York to rest because Minneapolis is just like every night there's stuff going on. So.
Well, you, Jim, are going to be busy for the next couple of nights reading and performing Saturday, Monday, and Tuesday here in New York. You can find out more about it at the Soundcheck page on WNYC.org. We'll hear Paul Westerberg paying tribute to one of his heroes, Alex Chilton,
yes,
in this 1987 replacement song, Pleased to Meet Me. Jim Walsh, it's been a pleasure to have you on Soundcheck.
Thanks, Joel. Great to see you.
Coming up next on Soundcheck, James Brown gets the Ivy League treatment with a Princeton University symposium. And later, singer-songwriter Dar Williams performs live in our studio. Stay with us.